This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Their biggest source of fear is in fact the parent, even though the parents they're now living with are benign and want to do the best for them. The whole way the child has developed, their capacity to enter into relationships, particularly with parents, has been influenced by the very earliest of experiences.
Kim Golding is a clinical psychologist who has spent over a decade working with children that are looked after or have been adopted after facing serious trauma at home. She helps these children's new families to parent more effectively while guiding practitioners to combine their knowledge of developmental trauma, attachment, interpersonal neurobiology, and child development to support these families. Kim has a love of writing and has authored numerous books. She was mentored by Dan Hughes, the creator of Dyadic Developmental Psychotherapy and Practice. Her work asks parents to make playfulness, empathy, acceptance, and curiosity the cornerstone of how they deal with challenging behavior. I'm Teresa Taylor, and this is the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health's In Conversation podcast. I spoke to Kim ahead of her upcoming appearance as the keynote speaker at an association conference focusing on dyadic developmental psychotherapy, parenting, and practice. Kim, over the years, your work has focused on understanding the impact of early experience on the development of children. What is developmental trauma?
Well, developmental trauma is a term that people are using to try and capture the particular traumatic experience of children who have been hurt within their family of origin. So it's trauma that has occurred early in life within the family and impacts on the child's development. And people are arguing that that's different from other sorts of trauma and is better captured with, not with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, although some of these children can indeed have that disorder anyway, but it doesn't capture the particular trauma that these children have, and children can be missed with that more diagnostic category. So developmental trauma it's not a diagnosis, but it's in common usage now as a way to describe the trauma these children have experienced.
Now, you're a great proponent of dyadic developmental psychotherapy and practice, which was developed to aid families with adopted or fostered children who have had developmental trauma. Can you tell us more about how this works?
Well, DDP, as you say, we tend to use the term dyadic developmental psychotherapy and practice. Originally, dyadic developmental psychotherapy was developed by a psychologist in America called Dr. Daniel Hughes. Dan was very interested in finding ways to meet the needs of these children who weren't responding to more conventional treatments of the day. And he set about trying to find a way that actually improved their well-being in their families and in the world at large. So he came up with this therapy model, which over the years has been expanded into what we're calling a practice model, because it's not just a therapy anymore. It's about a way of informing the environments around the child, so a way of informing the parenting of the children, the schooling of the children, as well as meeting the therapeutic needs of the children.
Okay, so it goes beyond just being there in the therapy room, but is about supporting their entire environment.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the big strengths of DDP, is it doesn't just sit as a therapy for the children. And in fact, you could argue to say that the therapy will be much less effective if the worlds the children are inhabiting 24/7 and not also influenced by the DDP principles. So there's a big emphasis on helping parents to understand ways of connecting with the children so that they can feel more secure, so the children can feel more secure with their parent, and the way that teachers indeed can do that in school and other people who meet the child. So it's much broader. The therapy itself very much focuses on increasing the security of attachment and the comfort or trust in relationships that children have lost because of their early experience. But that therapy itself isn't going to be helpful in and of its own if other people aren't also helping the children in their day-to-day life.
So as you say, there's sort of these various players that are assisting these children. It could be educators, it could be therapists, it could be other types of professional social workers. But even the label parent, I mean, my understanding is that the people playing the roles of parents are not necessarily biological parents. It could be uncles and aunts, it could be foster parents, it could be people in children's homes. So even the label parent can be quite a wide one, quite a variety of people playing that attachment figure role in a child's life.
Sure, and you missed out a big group there, which is adopters. So many of these children go on to live in adoptive families, and they would all of these parents, caregivers, you know, are acting in the role of as parents. So parents are a good term to cover what they're trying to offer for the children. But you're right, the therapy and practice model is much more used with children who are living in families not with their biological parents, perhaps with relatives or with, you know, the list you said, foster carers, adopters, kinship carers, residential carers.
And in terms of attachment, my understanding is that creating secure attachments is one of the key goals of DDP.
Sure, it's bigger than attachment. The attachment a child forms with their family is pivotal. It's a pivotal experience which will influence their ongoing development, especially their mental health and emotional well-being. So sure, a primary aim of any intervention with these children, and of course for DDP, is to help the child feel more secure in their attachment relationships. But moving beyond that, we also want to help the child to trust in those relationships in a way that they haven't been able to. One of the key terms we talk about, one of the key theories we talk about, is intersubjectivity, which is a theory of relationship developed by Colwyn Trevathan. It looks beyond the attachment relationship to the way children form their relationships more generally, and in particular, their capacity to enter into reciprocal relationships, the give and take of relationships that I'll influence you, I'm open to your influence. And what we find with this particular group of children is, whilst they're very good at influencing relationships, we see a lot of very controlling behaviours in these children, they're very poor at allowing others to influence them. They fear the influence of others because the very earliest influences they experienced were deeply hurtful for them.
One of the rarely impactful things that you've written about children with developmental trauma is that they're often frightened to be parented and as a result can display a lot of really challenging behavior. How does DDP and the work that you do deal with that anxiety around being parented?
I think by acknowledging that and helping the parents to acknowledge and accept that that is how the children feel, that their biggest source of fear is in fact the parent, even though the parents they're now living with are benign and want to do the best for them. The whole way the child has developed, their nervous system has developed, their capacity to enter into relationships, particularly with parents, has been influenced by the very earliest of experiences, which we're beginning to understand a little bit more about now as we're understanding more about the neuroscience behind the development of these children. Still early days for that, but we are getting more understanding. So we need to help the children to recover from this fear that if I open myself up to a parent in a kind of truly reciprocal way, allow myself to be open to their influence, I will get hurt again. And to help them to see that they can do this safely and it will not be hurtful. And in fact, it will be beneficial for them.
Some of what you talk about is promoting connection before correction, because just addressing the behavior when you have challenging behavior with a developmentally traumatized child can actually sometimes escalate that and make that worse. Can you tell us a bit more about why that is?
Sure. I mean, the little term connection before correction was something that Dan came up with to try and capture something of the importance of moving beyond just using discipline, parental, ordinary, good enough parental discipline with these children, that actually for children in a state of mistrust, or what Dan Hughes working with John Balin has called block trust, that discipline actually feels like abandonment. It feels like they're going to be hurt again. So ordinary discipline, the things that work very well, very tried and tested ways of helping children to manage in the world, is actually particularly problematic for this group of children. So they can't do without it. Children do need to have discipline in their lives. That's how they learn how to behave appropriately, how to be, you know, develop in pro-social situations, how to live in the world. So We recognise, and Dan used the word correction to explain discipline, not meaning punishment, but more meaning behavioural support, the support that allows children to behave appropriately and comfortably for them as well as for everyone else. But we need to recognise that for developmentally traumatised children, discipline alone is not going to help. It's just going to reinforce their sense of, I'm not good enough, you'll get rid of me one day, this is all going to go horribly wrong. So we have to put much more emphasis onto emotional connection with these kids. Emotional connection that we do very naturally with babies and toddlers, but generally older children, you don't need to pay so much attention to them. It's there, it's been there from birth. The child trusts in their parents, they trust in their parents' good intention. They know they have an emotional connection that feels safe. But for developmentally traumatised children, sadly, this experience is not their experience. So they do not trust in connection. So if they can't trust in connection, they're not going to feel secure with their parents, and they're not going to benefit from the really good discipline that parents are there to offer their children.
One of the core underliers that DDP uses to promote this connection is something called the PACE model. Can you tell us a little bit more about PACE and how it works?
Yes, we tend to call it an attitude rather than a model, mainly because we want to get across that PACE, which I should say stands for playfulness, acceptance, curiosity and empathy. The use of this attitude helps to build security for the children. It's a way of being. It's not a strategy or a technique. So the word model would be slightly misrepresenting it. It's more a way of being with the children, which pays much more attention on the emotional connection with them. The connection we kind of take for granted with secure children, but we can't take for granted with these children. So being aware of the importance of understanding the child's internal experience, that's your curiosity, communicating that understanding via your empathy. With acceptance, your internal experience is neither right nor wrong, it just is. And a healthy dose of playfulness, which obviously helps all relationships along. It's just quite a simple mnemonic, really, just to capture that basic parenting style, which these children just seem to benefit so much from.
When you're asking parents to be open and connected in this way, I mean, parents can also often need support exploring their own developmental histories and attachments, perhaps their own emotional needs, fears and hopes. Why is it so important for professionals to offer this type of support to parents?
Oh, it's absolutely central to supporting these children. In fact, if we don't support the parents, then any interventions we do with the children are probably not going to be helpful. That's because living with these children and parenting these children can be deeply hurtful. The children unwittingly can behave in ways which are highly rejecting for the parents. They're offering connection and the child's saying, not interested, thank you. And in a similar way, you might find with parents of children with profound autisms, that can be, you know, where they try and offer connection and the child doesn't know how to use it because of their disability. In this case, the parent is offering connection and the child doesn't want to use it, doesn't want to be connected because of their fear. And that can feel very rejecting. So this can have an impact on the parent such that they stop being open and engaged to their children. They try and protect themselves quite understandably. And we need to offer them the support, the emotional support that allows them to keep staying open and engaged to their children, keep offering the connection until the children can dare to give it a go, can dare to reciprocate with this connection. So without that kind of layer of support, the parents are just going to get worn down. We use the term block care to talk about the impact it has on their nervous system, where their caregiving systems literally stop working for them when they're feeling so hurt and rejected by the child and the way the child is communicating their pain and fear. So we need to help them not move into block care, help them come out of block care when they do move into it. So the layer of support we offer to parents is absolutely pivotal to helping these children get the lives they deserve.
Now, to think a bit about education and the roles that schools play, you've written books on ways for educators to identify and help children with trauma in the classroom. What can educators gain from DDP?
We're probably early days at bringing DDP into the classroom, as it were. Yes, I've done some writing, and colleagues of mine, Louise Bomber particularly, have done a lot of writing about how to help schools to be more aware of the attachment needs and the trauma of this group of children. And the DDP principles can be very helpful to the teachers to help support them in ways of connecting with their children in the classroom and in the school environment. I would say we're more early days. We've probably done a lot more work on working with parents and helping parents to understand this. But we're beginning to get requests from schools to go in and provide this sort of training in schools, building on the work that Louise Bomber has done, which has been phenomenal in helping schools to become much more aware of the trauma needs of the children and to have strategies which are all very concordant with the DDP model to actually help children settle in the classroom.
And to think about professionals at large, you've been involved in the setting up of the Integrated Service for Looked After and Adopted Children in Worcester. And this is a service that provides support for parents, for schools, for professionals. What did doing that work teach you about the role that various professionals can play in supporting children and families with this developmental trauma?
It was pivotal in my understanding, because in developing and delivering the service, it brought me into contact with a lot of the professionals, practitioners and parents around and supporting the looked after and adopted children. So over the, I'm thinking 13, 14 years that I was with that service, I could firsthand see the struggles that the adults around these children can have, the perplexity, how hard it is to understand the children and the way that the children demonstrate their difficulties through their behaviours, and the difficulties in bringing in ways of supporting these children whilst also fitting in with the normal, like, so you talk about schools, you know, teachers have a hard job. They have a lot of children in the classroom. It's difficult for them to see a child who maybe needs a different approach and how to fit that in amongst all the other children they've got. So we need to find ways of helping teachers to adopt some of the DDP principles within the environment. So because we did a lot of network working within ISL, we got a lot of insight into that and into the challenges of that, and hopefully some kind of sensitivity to the difficulty of supporting these children in the ways that they need to be supported.
In terms of this group of children, looked after children and adopted children, how have their needs been addressed historically in the UK? Is there a change? Things like DDP, are they receiving more attention? Or what are the real areas where perhaps it's still lacking in the support that they get and for their families?
I think there's still a lack of resources, but that's true of mental health generally. So children who come into mental health services, says everyone is working very hard with limited resources to meet those children's needs. This group of children are particularly complex and perhaps need longer, more intensive interventions than we traditionally offer in our child and adolescent mental health services. There are services that are allowed to do that or enabled to do that. So ISL is a good example of a service attached to CAMHS, not within CAMHS, but attached to CAMHS, that can offer these children and families a more in-depth series of interventions, wraparound interventions. Have we got it right yet? No, I don't think we have. I think we need a lot more attention to the challenges that the families can have when a child has developmental trauma. I'm thinking adopters, the Adoption Support Fund was brought in as a way of trying to meet the needs of the families who have adopted these children, but it doesn't go far enough, and there's not enough emphasis on the parenting needs, the parents' needs for these children. So we're not there yet by any means, but it's certainly developed in the time that I've been involved.
What we've been discussing will be key to your address at the conference. How will you be bringing some of these concepts across to attendees, and what can they expect from the day?
I will just be talking. I will be telling stories. But storytelling is very at the heart of DDP, so lecturing tends not to be so connecting as telling stories. So I will be telling stories about some of the families and children I've worked with, linking that to the model, the DDP model, and helping people to understand hopefully a little bit more about the challenges that these children come into the world with and different ways that we can support them in overcoming those challenges.
And who do you think would benefit from attending the conference?
Well, I hope a wide range of practitioners, whatever role that they're playing in the world of children with developmental traumas. So certainly mental health practitioners, social workers, teachers, you know, the range of people. We've just been talking about how important it is to get the world that these children are inhabiting on a day-to-day basis, understanding the challenges that they have and understanding ways of responding to them that builds their security. So anyone who wants to improve the security of a child with developmental trauma, I think we'll find something of interest within the presentation.
Kim Golding will be the keynote speaker at the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health's Dyadic Developmental Psychotherapy Parenting and Practice Conference. It'll be held in Cardiff on the 23rd of May. For those who can't attend, there'll be a live stream of the event. Please visit www.acamh.org for more details.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.